Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by Hover. Register a domain name with Hover and build your online brand today. Go to hover.com/twit and save 10% off your first purchase.
Back in black, iMac Pro, CPUs in a meltdown, and hack your DNA at home. Live from the Twit Eastside Studios in beautiful Petaluma, it's the new screensavers.
James Hetfield of Metallica in the studio today. Thank you. No, that's not James. It's Ryan from Sacramento. Great to have you, although you have that voice. You could do that. Yeah, it was good. That was good. Thank you, Ryan. Hey, we're going to have a lot of fun. Look who's here, Jason Snell.
Hello.
From The Incomparable in Six Colors.
I'm happy to be here.
Nice
to.
Well, your timing is excellent because look what we have.
I know, right?
You and I are the two people in the world who own an iMac Pro.
I know a few other people who bought them. And you know Rene Ritchie.
Did he buy one?
I think that's the only way you can get one is by buying.
They're not lending them out.
Unless you were in one of those early people who like
the YouTubers who bought them.
Yeah. Yeah, and the developers and the designers.
Well, we're going to give you our iMac Pro review. This is episode 138, recorded Saturday, January 6th, 2018. Our first show of the year, the new year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too. Did you have a nice New Year?
Absolutely. Didn't go anywhere. Didn't do anything. The best.
Sounds perfect. I went to bed at 8 on New Year's Eve.
I stayed up.
To 9?
I have friends who have little kids. They just put the Netflix countdown on. You can literally do that at any point during the day. And then the kids count down. They don't know any better. And then you put them to bed.
So you mean the countdown is not a real-time countdown. It's a video countdown.
Netflix video that's like the 5-minute countdown. And you just play it. And then everybody counts
Happy
down.
New Year! Go to bed, kids.
And then the kids go to bed. Yeah, that's the way to do it.
Oh, that's definitely the way.
Pro tip.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So we've got some really good stuff. As I said, we've got the new iMac Pro. Two owners. We've both had it about a week, right?
Yeah.
And we'll give you our rundown on what is currently the most expensive Macintosh. Maybe not the fastest. We'll talk about what that means exactly. But there's no doubt it is the most expensive. In fact, Jason says the most expensive computer you've ever bought.
Yes, and I bought the base model, so that really says something about how expensive the iMac Pro is.
Well, we're going to put it through its paces here. If you've ever heard of biohacking, you'll be interested in our guest. Josiah Zahner is here. There he is. Don't look at those muscles. Those are genetically modified muscles. He also eats poop, but that's another story. No, he does it all in his DIY lab. The poop is different. It's a good thing. Don't call it poop. Call it a fecal transplant. Jason Howell has 7 apps to help you complete your New Year's resolutions.
Are we still calling them New Year's resolutions, Leo?
No. Suggestions. Serving suggestions. New Year's thoughts.
Okay, good.
Because nobody ever. By now, everybody's broken their New Year's resolution.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a week, so yeah.
This guy is several hundred years New Year's old. So he never. His resolution, I'm going over there. And that's it.
He works on that for the whole year.
It takes a whole year. We're going to answer your questions and call for help. We got a mailbag or two. Of course, the big story this week is the meltdown and Spectre for CPU.
Oh, yeah. Boy.
Wow. And who better to explain that to us than Steve Gibson? It's funny because Steve talked about it on Tuesday on Security Now before, like, all the media attention. And he just was very matter of fact. And, you know, this could be a problem. Might slow down systems. We'll see. Like, the next day, everybody's hair is on fire.
Yep. Freak out happened.
Freak out. Yep. How bad is it? We'll talk about it. And how safe are you at this point? But first, the hot topics. And I don't know. This has nothing to do with tech.
This is the best story of the week, though. Come on.
Yeah, it is. The bomb cyclone, right? There's the Pacific, up in New England, it's like minus something degrees. It's freezing. It's snowing. It's blizzarding. Hope you're staying warm and staying safe out there.
Wind chill of minus 100 Fahrenheit at Mount Washington, New Hampshire.
That's apparently crazy cold. Crazy. Don't go outside. Stay inside. But even Florida is getting crazy cold. It snowed in Tallahassee. Right. Snowed in Florida. And apparently it's so cold that iguanas, you know, those big lizards, are falling out of the trees.
Well, they're cold-blooded, right? So they get a little too cold. They don't know what to do. They kind of pass out. And they fall to the ground.
Leading to my favorite story of the week.
Florida man.
Florida man picks up a dozen frozen iguanas. He thinks they're dead, puts them in the back seat, drives off with them. No, they're not. As they warmed up in the car, they got frisky.
You put the heater on in the car, and then the iguanas just come back to life.
They got frisky. And you don't want a frisky iguana in your back seat, I can tell
you. No, it's not a good idea. And Australia has drought bears. It's nice to know Florida is keeping up with
drop iguanas.
Do you know, that's like, it's like a legend about like a murderous koala that drops out of the eucalyptus tree and kills you. Yeah.
Yikes. Some guy puts a video up on YouTube, 10-hour video. It's for how people sleep. 10 hours of
white noise, right? Just gentle
What is
hissing.
White noise?
It's like a broadband noise.
I think it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
It's like
static. Essentially static is white noise, just pure static.
You can't copyright that.
No.
Well, maybe you can. There are five. The guy put up a video on YouTube and got five copyright complaints within 10 minutes. Apparently, there are other people who've put white noise up. And I don't, you know, this is ridiculous.
YouTube's system lets people who are supposedly content creators upload things and say, I own the copyright to these. And the problem is sometimes the stuff that gets uploaded, they don't own it.
You said you got a copyright hit from a guy who said, what happened?
So I did one of these Animoji videos, and it was the Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, right? I was doing the Khan thing, right?
I remember that. It was great.
And thank you. There was a guy, and I don't own the copyright on that.
We played it on Mac Break Weekly.
Yeah, if Paramount Pictures wants to say that they own that, that's fair. They do own that. Instead, some band that took that clip from Star Trek II and put it in between tracks on their album, and then they apparently uploaded their whole album and claimed that it was all under their copyright. And they're like, we would like to put ads on your Animoji video.
Which means
now
Paramount is also getting copyright claims from this band, which
presumably,
is ironic.
Presumably, right? And there's a process, right? You appeal it. This guy does. The problem is it'll take several weeks for the appeal to go through. And
meanwhile, they're making money on your video.
I think you can, if you dispute it, they turn off all the ads on your video, so nobody's making money.
No,
on the video,
you aren't?
Which is fine. I didn't want to make money on my video anyway. I just didn't want them
to. That's kind of the scam, though, is that they, if you can get, there it is, by the way. This was the whole dialogue from that famous.
You can't kill just about everyone else.
Yeah.
But like,
not an album, after all. I can Shatner.
You do a great Shatner as a fox.
Yes, with a weird twitching eye, but that's an emoji for you.
I love the dramatic pause.
Perhaps I no longer need to try.
Ricardo Chicken Bond.
Yeah, it's good. You know, that's good. Very 2017, the Animoji videos. We're already past it now.
That was over. That is over.
Apple needs to come out with new Animoji, or we're just done.
You might as well do the Harlem Shuffle. That's over.
But we did that once.
Yes, we broke
you
the
and
table.
Me. We did break the table.
Yes, you were there, hey? Let's see. World leaders. Okay, so here's some good news and bad news. So, after President Trump's tweet about starting a nuclear war, some could say that's a hostile gesture.
I had some concerns, yes.
He didn't say he was going to start it. He just said he had a big button.
Big button.
And
biggest,
it worked.
The biggest button.
He has the biggest button
all
on his desk,
buttons,
and it worked.
Yeah.
Weird thing, but, not the weirdest thing. Let's face it, the president has tweeted. A number of people said, hey, you have policies, Twitter, that say you can't threaten violence. You'll get banned on Twitter. And, in fact, somebody put a projector, they do this all the time, in San Francisco, and projected up against the Twitter building, @Jack, #, you're complicit, to kind of say, and there was a lot of protests around that. Twitter has responded, we don't block world leaders.
That's all. So if you're thinking of buying your own private island and declaring independence, you may be able to do anything you want on Twitter.
I am really of two minds on this. On the one hand, I understand what Twitter's saying is you can see what they think. That's important. What if, now, so Hitler, let's say Hitler had Twitter. Let's go back. Well, no, you got to do this, right? Because he's, I don't know, Ayatollah Khomeini.
I didn't know we were violating Godwin's law here. But
pick somebody, all right? On the one hand, you could say, well, at least we would know what Hitler was thinking about and planning, right?
But you're also giving him a platform.
But you're giving him a platform. That's the other side of it, is that he could win, adherence.
Yes, and or whip up his adherence into
and,
a fervor.
And in fact, he did say everything he was going to do. He wrote a book called Mein Kampf. He said everything, and he did it. So we knew 20 years before exactly what he was going to do.
I mean,
but he didn't have the big megaphone of Twitter, right?
Kim Jong-un does not have a Twitter account, right? So far as we know. There are only parody
accounts.
Why not?
He should really.
This is my concern, right, is that they end up in a little Twitter war.
But that would be bad, right? Because we've seen Twitter wars escalate.
Bad. I think that might be bad. And then somebody blocks somebody else, and then that's...
So I understand both. So I'm on Twitter's side of this. You don't block the president of the United States.
It's kind of hard.
You just don't.
It's too late.
But if you don't block him, you don't block... the Ayatollah, let's say Osama bin Laden is still alive. Would you block Osama bin Laden? Twitter says yes.
Yes.
Some might reasonably consider him a leader. I don't know. It's complicated.
I think the bottom line is that Twitter finds a lot of value in having the spotlight shined on them by having the president of the United States use Twitter. And so they're going to ride that, and they're going to stick their fingers in their ears when people tell them that they should. La, 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 I can't hear you.
I do that anyway.
That's how you block people in real life.
Yeah. I don't.
That's a Twitter block in real life. Just stick your fingers in your ears.
All right, let's get Steve Gibson online, because really the truth is we're burying the lead. The big story of the week, and probably of the year,
is frozen iguanas, but second is a huge security problem.
And it's appropriately named Meltdown Inspector. Hi, Steve.
Yo, Leo. Great to be with you guys.
Host of Security Now, our great security show every Tuesday on the network. And so when we talked about this on Tuesday, you knew all about it, right?
Yep. Yep.
And I'm listening. We kind of talked a little bit about it. I said, oh, that reminds me of Roehammer. But did we underestimate its impact?
I don't think so. And I think a lot of this is still unknown. That is the ultimate effects. There's no attack that has ever been constructed. So far, this is a theoretical vulnerability, which doesn't mean it doesn't need to be taken seriously, because we always see in security that theoretical vulnerabilities often become actual. So this is something important. And what I think it mostly shows is that there's a long overlooked problem in the security of all recent architectures of computers. What we're assuming is that the programs that the user runs has no access to the operating system underneath, a so-called kernel, or that multiple programs running on a system don't have access to each other. That is, there's this crucial assumption about the isolation between different things going on that are happening at the same time on the same computer. And the design enforces this isolation, but these different things are still running on the same hardware. And what has come to light in the last, well, technically in the last few months, because this was kept on the down low, you know, on the QT for some time while engineers scurried around trying to figure out what to do about this. But what is now publicly understood, what is common knowledge, is that there are very subtle footprints which are left behind by any software running on modern processors. So one of those is the contents of the so-called caches, which keep recently accessed information near the chip so it can access it again. And another is that modern processors speculate what may be about to be asked for by the software, because that allows it to get ahead. And it's one of the major ways that new systems are able to operate faster, is that they guess. And in order to guess, they have to use the recent history of what the software has done under the assumption, oh, it's probably going to do that again. Well, it turns out that all of these things, the so-called branch prediction, which fork in the road the software is going to take, that leaves a trail in branch counters. And the contents of caches can be probed by asking for some specific information and accurately measuring how long it takes to get it back. That lets you know, ooh, was it in the cache, in which case we got it quickly, or did the system have to go out and get it again from main memory? So essentially, there's been a sort of a sudden leap forward in our appreciation and potential ability to leverage these very subtle footprints, which any software running on today's processors leaves behind.
So I'm going to say a few things. Tell me how close I am to the truth, because you understand this at a deeper level than I do. And then there's a whole bunch of people who don't know or just immediately go, I don't, what are you talking about? So and unfortunately, people like the Today Show, which basically said, get rid of your Mac, are misinterpreting this and overemphasizing the danger. So there is a leak of information from the cache due to speculative execution of the processor. All Intel processors since 1995 have been doing this, by the way. At first, AMD put out a press release that implied, oh, it's just Intel. And then Intel said, no, AMD too, because they also use speculative execution. Even ARM processors, not the Raspberry Pi, not the dumb ARM processors, but even high-end ARM processors do speculative execution, have L2 caches. So this is a theoretical, in fact, proven, not theoretical, possibility in all three processors. There's two different teams. The Spectre and the Meltdown are two different exploits, but fundamentally accomplish the same thing. But like Rowhammer, the bad guy can't say what information he's going to get. He can't say, give me your password. He's just going to get a blob of information, right?
So, yes, there's some level of information leakage possible if a whole bunch of preconditions are set
up. You'd have to be really good to write a program to do this.
Yes, and the problem is that modern processors give the software access to fine-grained, like single-cycle timing and fine-grained history information. One of the interesting ideas about mitigating these problems across the board is to say, wait a minute, it's one thing for developers and compilers that need to optimize their performance to have that kind of access, but running software just doesn't need it. No software needs to do that level of navel gazing in order to figure out if it's doing the fastest job it can. So the idea of simply removing this level of granular access to time and the history of the footsteps, that would sort of blind software from its ability to do that.
Ah, but wouldn't it slow it down? That's what everybody's worried about. And this all started with the Register's article, which said mitigation would cause a 5 to 30% slowdown. You even mentioned this in passing on Tuesday. You said there might be some slowdown. Is there a slowdown?
So the slowdown would come from the most blunt-edged solution, which is to flush the cache, but whenever a piece of code calls the operating system.
Yikes.
But to do that requires a massive reload of the cache for the operating system. The idea being that right now we're not doing that.
It would eliminate the benefit of L2 cache.
Well, yes, and that would be a dramatic performance hit.
Okay.
But we really don't know how much, because the more back and forth between the user code and the operating system there is, the greater the problem. So some programs that weren't like doing a whole lot of I/O operations, which
quick.
Is generally in the operating system,
they would
not get hit bad.
Right.
But something that was doing intensive disk operations or communications, it would tend to suffer more.
Yeah. There are other mitigations, though. Apple mentions, for instance, that this could potentially, although it'd be difficult, be done in JavaScript. So you could actually theoretically use Safari and go to a website, and that website could have code that would just say, well, just take a look at what's in the cache, just in case there's a password or a credit card number or something we could use there. Again, it's just going to be random what they're going to get, but you hit enough computers, you might get something of value. You'd also have to be pretty sophisticated interpreting it, right? I mean,
Right. It's sort of like a web page that checks to see if you left anything behind on your clipboard.
Right.
Well, if people were like using their clipboard to cut and paste their passwords, then such software would get lucky.
Your clipboard's but a much
you might
more
just get nothing.
A much better target-rich environment than your L2 cache. Right. Anyways, Apple says we're going to mitigate it nevertheless in iOS and in Safari. We are going to fix that, and they say that that is a impact on Jetstream of less than 2.5%. It is an impact, but it's a 2.5% is probably not noticeable.
Right.
Intel and AMD both say they're going to do a fix. So would that be a microcode fix in the processor?
It could very well be. That's one of the things that could be done, is that there could be a way of preventing software from accessing these counters. They've just been hit like, hey, we have this information for our own use, says the processor. Everybody else might as well have it too. Well,
maybe
everybody
not.
Else doesn't need it.
Yeah. Okay. And then Microsoft says we've fixed this in Insider Editions of Windows. We're pushing that out. There will be a patch on Patch Tuesday, but I gather that there have been out-of-cycle patches already, some of which have caused blue screens of death on AMD processors.
Last Wednesday, right?
Apple has pushed, and it says if you're using 10.13.2, you're okay, but it sounds like they also have some additional fixes to push out.
Yeah, and it sounds like a lot of this stuff is everybody's been working
scrambling.
On it. And we'll continue to work on it.
Yeah.
And we may see more granular fixes down the road,
right.
I would think, instead of right now where it's just like you just got to get it out there. Because now that everybody knows, that also means the bad guys know. And this has gone from being theoretical to being something that people who want to break into your system are also now looking at, not just the security researchers.
What I think we're probably going to see is short-term emergency patches,
which
may induce some performance hit. But that's sort of like an interim fix. Once the microcode has the chance to be edited to solve the underlying problem, then these patches can be removed safely. So we'll get back future performance without having the security problem.
And while it is prudent to do this, and of course I expect everybody, every operating system, every microprocessor manufacturer to address this, how big of a threat is this right now?
It's purely, if I may use the term speculative, we're speculating that this could be a problem because we've seen similar problems that were successfully turned into exploits. So no one wants to take a chance. It's unfortunate that Intel stock got hit the way it did because
That's not fair.
They were the first people in the targets. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at this point, no one has actually turned this into an exploit. It's all theoretical. But that doesn't mean we don't have to take it seriously.
Yeah. And even if it is turned into an exploit, it's hard to imagine it being really effective. Although, was Rowhammer ever used?
Rowhammer has successfully pulled passwords from other processors or has been used to get a little bit of a beachhead on a shared system. I think, and the end user...
That's, by the way, a huge issue is the shared systems like VMware, Hyper-V, and both Google and Microsoft temporarily have shut down Azure and AWS, I think shut down AWS, to make patches because that's a bigger risk because you're all multiple people running on one processor, right?
Right. So what we know is that if any of us download malware, we're in trouble.
Right.
But in a shared system where you have cloud computing,
you can intentionally run malware.
Exactly. Exactly.
And sit on a machine.
In order to get to somebody else's shared co-resident system.
And that would be a better target-rich environment because you'd just be getting dumped all the time and you could look through it manually or perhaps use a process and try to understand what you're getting.
So one thing that I do want to mention, and maybe, Steve, you've got a perspective on this, is just because this is all theoretical and these are sort of almost like scientific papers, they're white papers explaining that this is a thing that was a possibility, it's been speculated about for years, it doesn't necessarily mean that nobody knew about it and was using it in secret, because we have heard of a lot of security issues that are discovered by a government, an intelligence agency, and they don't report it. And it's possible, since this is potentially a very old technique. It could have been used 5 or 10 years ago, even, that it is possible that somebody out there, a state intelligence agency or something, could be have been using it all this time, isn't it?
Yep. Yep. And in fact, you know, in our imagination, you can imagine someone at the NSA going, ooh.
Yep. Yeah.
Like this
missed
is weird.
It by that much.
Because that's what
they
happens sometimes.
Found
is,
it. They found
this is,
it.
This is a tool that they loved and they used and nobody knew about
well,
it.
Well, and it would be
like
a better
gold.
Better targeted tool. Because if I were trying to get Jason Snell's passwords, if I could run it on his machine, I'd have a better sense of what I'm looking for
exactly.
And what I'm getting.
Than so, just a web page somewhere.
Than just some random, you know.
Yeah, although we've seen with the election hacking, what you do is you can set up, yeah, you've set up an exploit and forge an email.
Go target it, spearfish.
And somebody clicks on the link and,
All right. So, Steve, not a hair on fire time, but certainly a time for prudence and awareness.
Yeah, I think in the technical and academic world, what's happened is that an assumption of isolation has been broken.
Yeah.
And people are freaked out because we depend upon isolation for our systems to be secure. So we got to fix that, and we will.
Yeah. All right. And I appreciate it. We'll talk, of course, in great depth about it on Tuesday on Security Now. We'll get maybe even more technical. But the thing to tell friends and family is, as always,
keep your computers. You're okay.
An update, as always, update. Yep. Because you don't need to know the technical details of any individual exploit. Just that when an operating system gets an update, there's a reason for it. And it's not because you're getting more pretty colors on the screen. It's
generally, it's better afterwards.
And better can mean many things to many people. Steve Gibson, you're the greatest. At SGGRC on Twitter if you want to communicate with him. And don't forget, Security Now is coming up this Tuesday, and we'll talk about it in great depth. Steve's right now working on a clever title for the show involving Meltdown, Spectre. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you'll have something great for us. Thanks, Steve.
Speculation. Bye.
I'm glad we could. I'm glad we could kind of talk to the expert on this and get the story on it, because I think there's kind of in a bad way. Mainstream media has really blown this up out of proportion.
And it's technical enough that you don't want to get it wrong, but at the same time, you don't necessarily need the level of technicality where this is like a scientific white paper kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's very theoretical.
It's very technical.
And so then, how do you explain that at a higher level while you're not, you know, regular people can understand it, but you're also not telling them the wrong thing?
Scott Hanselman, who is a programmer at Microsoft, actually had, to me, the best. He says, to a non-technical spouse explaining Meltdown, honey, you know how we finish each other's sandwiches? No, sentences. But you guessed sandwiches. It was in your mind for an instant, and that was a password, and somebody stole it while it was there, fleeting. Oh, that is bad. Not a perfect technical explanation of it, but that's the idea. By guessing, by speculative branching, speculative execution, you can get information that is hidden otherwise in the cache. That didn't help. All right. I hope we all feel better now. By the way, this is the default screensaver on the iMac. Whenever I see this on somebody's iMac, I think, why? What do you use for a screensaver?
I have one of the photo screensavers. I've got a folder full of space pictures from NASA that I use.
You don't even really need a screensaver, frankly. You could just let the screen go blank.
Those screens, you could. Those screens do suffer from
burn-in.
So you do want to have some of them do, and image retention. So
you want to have a little burn-in of my mouse because it's not moving.
The mouse should go away, should submarine away at some
you
point.
You should go away.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe
you tell it.
Maybe
you tell
accident.
It, Leo.
Go away, mouse. All right, we're going to do our iMac Pro review coming up in just a little bit. But first, a word from Hover, our sponsor for the show today. And you know we are big fans. Steve's a big fan of Hover. I don't think Steve knew Hover was a sponsor. I know he didn't. He was on one of the old legacy, as we all were. I can't remember which one. But, you know, the one that when in the early days of the web, everybody registered with. And he was not happy. He shouldn't have been happy. These guys overcharge. They don't give you good service. So he was looking for somebody else. He went on the Twitter and asked, what do you use? What do you recommend? And almost to a person, almost to a tweet, everybody said hover.com. And I use Hover. I've moved everything over to hover.com as well because it is the best. If you are registering a domain, and by the way, I shouldn't have to explain this, but I think you should know it's important to get a custom domain at the very least for your email, so you don't have to, you know, you could change email providers without having to change your email address. But if you have a business and you're still using at AOL.com or at Yahoo.com or even at Gmail.com, no. You need Fred's Plumbing Supplies.com.
Fred's Plumbing.
Dot plumbing. How about that?
Yeah.
Or Leo's brainwaves.marketing or Jason's red.wine.
I have liftoffpodcast.space for my podcast because it's about space. There's dot space.
There are more than 400 mm-hmm. top-level domain extensions, and look how creative they are. Sure, you can go with .com, .net, but frankly, there's stuff that's a lot better.
.actor. Come on, .actor.
.actor. I like .ninja. .tech, .network, .security, .software, .CEO,
.zone. .zone is pretty good.
I use .zone. I'm not going to say for what.
I have a .zone.
Top secret domain.
I have two .zones.
And it's awesome. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. In fact, I use custom domains for everything, for my home servers, for my email. It's kind of an addiction. Go to hover.com/twit. At least you could save 10% off your first purchase. They also have a very nice feature that means the more domains you own at Hover, the bigger your discount. And I get that discount. Boy, do I get that discount every time. The best place, a clean interface, no upselling. You get built-in free Whois privacy because they know you want that, but you don't have to check 100 boxes every time you buy a domain name. It's fast. It's easy. I love it. And Hover's Connect feature means if you've got a website, it's very easy to connect your domain name to that website. They've got just basically push-button connections with Hover Connect. Start building your online brand today. Go to hover.com/twit and get 10% off your first purchase. H-O-V-E-R. Hover.com/twit, and we thank Hover for their support of the new screensavers. So, I wasn't going to buy this. I wasn't.
Uh-huh.
I really wasn't.
Sure.
I wasn't. I was hoping, frankly, for a Mac Pro.
Every story of yours starts this way.
I know. I wasn't going to buy it, but I was going to wait for the Mac Pro, but there's no sign of the Mac Pro. We don't know. I haven't heard a rumor.
They've made no promises other than in the future they will release a Mac Pro.
They said is not in 2017.
Yeah, they didn't even say 2018. They just said in the future. Yeah. Right.
So I thought, well, I haven't bought an iMac in several years. I had the 5K iMac, which I really liked.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, let's get the new iMac Pro. And then I saw it starts. This is the one you got, base model, 8 cores. How much RAM do you get?
16?
No, you get 32.
32 and a terabyte. Yeah, that's it.
And a terabyte storage.
Yeah, I had 16 on my old 5.
You get the Radeon Pro Vega.
$49.99. Any car for $49.99.
But folks, you also get something no one else can get.
Black Lightning.
A Black Lightning cable. That comes with it.
You also get, okay, everybody knows, here's Magic Trackpad. That's fine.
Yeah.
What if...
Whoa!
It was in space gray instead.
Or what if the keyboard were... in space gray. Oh, or the mouse. Well, that's kind of almost black.
$5,000
really?
Peripherals here,
no,
folks.
That's not why you buy the iMac Pro. In fact, you shouldn't buy the iMac Pro if you have to ask. In my opinion, if
yes.
you have to ask, should I get the iMac Pro? The answer is no.
My father-in-law asked me. He's in the market for a new iMac.
Everybody
says,
should
I get that iMac Pro? That sounds good. And the answer is no, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Because it is really, first of all, the clock speed. Now, I got, I spent a little more than you did. This is the Rene Ritchie model.
Yeah, you got suckered into the 10-core.
Rene said, well, if you're going to get 8-core, you might as well get the 10-core because it's got the faster clock speed, 3 gigahertz. It's an Intel Xeon W.
It is probably the sweet spot because one of the challenges with these processors is for single-core performance, you want that fast single-core, and the 10 is a faster single-core in turbo boost and all of those things. But it's also, you spent a couple thousand more bucks.
It was $8,000.
Yeah.
I got 64 gigs of RAM because I was told by both Alex Lindsay and Rene Ritchie, there's no point in getting 128 gigs unless you really know you need it.
Okay, yeah, that's
64
that's
is probably enough.
It's probably a lot.
Probably enough. I did get the higher video card, the Radeon Pro Vega 6416. Mm-hmm. One of the problems, of course, with all of Apple's devices is, but particularly with the video cards, they're not upgradable. And they aren't already. They're not like top of the line video cards.
That's right.
So they're
fitting them into the thermal balance of this system, which has got more fan capacity than the old iMac Pro, iMac does. But still, it's got to fit in there. And presumably, look, if this product exists, we know there's a Mac Pro coming. Then that makes us ask that question, what would be different about the Mac Pro other than the screen?
Upgradable.
It's got to be things like upgradable GPU.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Nevertheless, this is a fairly beefy GPU. We've been doing some work on here with Motion. This is a project to build our logo that Anthony Nielsen created that is normally an overnight thing. Actually, we turned on Motion Blur in Motion, which... Anthony says, I wouldn't even do that at all because it would never finish.
Yeah, because it adds like 16 more cycles.
So it gave an estimate of about 30 minutes. Now it's up to an hour, probably because it went to sleep, so it stopped working.
Yeah.
But it's halfway done in about half an hour.
And that's the kind of stuff that benefits from the iMac Pro.
Exactly.
This has got 10 cores, and of course, it's 20 virtual cores. Mine's got 16 virtual cores, 8 real cores. And that's the speed difference. If you use software that is properly multi-threaded, software that is going to use every single bit of processor core that's available, you want this system. If all the stuff you do just sits like a word processor or something, sits on a single core...
There are faster single-core iMacs.
Yeah, right.
This is not the fastest iMac for single-core performance.
Right, because what you're getting is you're giving up a little bit of single-core performance, although the 10-core is pretty good. The 10-core is pretty fast as a single-core.
Right. I'm going to quit out of... Well, actually, why quit out of Motion? One of the advantages of having 10 cores and 20 threads is you can do more than one thing. Yeah. So we're going to launch a game called... that's very popular, called Fortnite. It's a battle royale game. 100 people enter, one... succeeds. And this is going to benefit in a couple of ways. It uses Metal, which is Apple's direct to the hardware graphics programming language. So it's going to benefit from that processor. And I'm going to do something that normally you really don't want to do, which is I'm going to... what is going on here? It's trying to sell me something.
Yeah, you want to go to the Battle Royale.
I went to the wrong one. That's right. I'm going to go to... Let's go to the video settings and just let's see if we can really tax this thing. I'm going to set the quality to epic.
Epic, sure.
I'm going to set it to full screen. And I'm going to set it to, wait a minute, can we get a higher resolution? I want a higher, let's go, what is the native resolution? Is it 3840 by 2160? Something like that. That's the highest resolution the game will do. Epic 3D, epic view distance, epic shadows, epic anti-aliasing, epic textures, epic effects. I'm going to show the FPS so we can see what we're doing here. Now, how do you feel? Let's turn the settings up all the way on this game. And by the way, I've been playing it this way, which is nice. And I'm not very good at it. So I'll tell you what, let's play and I'm going to get killed right away, which will mean that it's going to continue to play following whoever kills
me. So this is an accurate rendition of you playing the game.
Yes. This is exactly what it looks like when I play Fortnite. I get killed right away. By the way, I didn't intentionally pick that character, but I'd like to stay that person. All right, let's see if we're going to... It's waiting for a server. This has a 10 gigabit Ethernet connection, which is kind of funny because...
There's a lot of high-end video stuff where your storage is just as fast as if it were local storage.
Yeah, yeah. You'd have to have a special switch and all that because
exactly.
We're gigabit. And it definitely, when I did a speed test on this during Mac Break Weekly, we were able to get to 1.3 gigabits, which is as fast as I've ever seen... On any system in our facility, we have 10 gigabits, but the switch won't give you more than a gig. Are we playing the game now? Can you see it?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have to wait for the bus to come, and then it's going to drop me into the game. This guy up in front of me, what a doofus. Anyway, so we've maxed it out. It's running at 65 frames per second.
Yeah.
It could go faster. I took the limiter off. But 65 is smooth, especially considering I've maxed out everything.
Now, I think it's fair to say that if you're buying an iMac Pro, you're probably not doing it to play games, but you can.
Would it be a good gaming machine?
Well, Well, if you're a PC gamer, no. But if you're somebody who needs this for other things and also want to play games on it, it would be okay.
Then
Boot Camp works with it. Yeah. I installed Boot Camp on mine the other day. One of the security features of this system, it's got a whole secure boot system. One of the security features is it checks the operating systems to be signed, or it won't boot them by default.
Right.
And it supports the Windows 10 Creators Update, so it will actually look at Microsoft Signature and approve that, too. So Apple's built in all the Boot Camp support, so you can reboot and play play a Steam game or whatever else you want in Windows. But again, this is not a gaming PC. This is an iMac for designers, creative pros, people like that.
And okay, you may but also I could play games on it.
Oh, yeah, I'm totally going to play games on mine. And it's also for VR development. It's got VR support, which Macs haven't had before. You can plug in few of the VR glasses, and you can actually start to build VR or edit VR stuff in Final Cut.
One thing I learned, you have to buy dongles for your cinema displays, because notice there's no DisplayPort or even Thunderbolt 2 out of here. It's all Type-C Thunderbolt 3, and it's got four
Apple generously put USB-A on the back, the classic USB ports.
At least I can use my USB-A stuff. You see,
and the USB-C.
There's also an SDXC card slot and an actual headphone jack, which is
very
generous. No lightning port, but you can always get a cable. You get one.
You get
black
the black
one.
Lightning.
You're set.
Right there.
That's all you need.
And then otherwise you go to Dongletown. So if you want anything else, you can adapt it.
Welcome to Dongletown.
Video,
so in
whatever.
Order to run three displays, let's see how fast I can get killed here. In order to run three displays on here, two additional displays, I had to buy a Thunderbolt 2 to Thunderbolt 3 Type-C adapter.
Oh, because of your displays, right.
And then I had, that's for the Thunderbolt cinema display. Then I have an LED cinema display, which uses DisplayPort, so I had to use a DisplayPort adapter.
But if you bought a couple of
third-party, like
5K,
those
5K displays, you can plug them right in. And this will drive, I believe, two external 5K displays.
I actually jumped off something and died.
Well, that's what we were going for,
right? Well, let's follow somebody else. Key changes is going to go running around. And you can see we're really getting nice frame rate, really good graphics. This is using metal, no slowdown. And best of all, I can switch back to my motion, and it's still rendering in the background
This isn't
pegging it.
It's a workstation, right? This is like any PC workstation. It's got enough power to do this stuff. The GPU is going to draw more power and generate more heat than the processor is. The fan doesn't spin up, really. In my experience, the fan is always running, more or less, but it's really quiet. You basically can't hear it.
It's running now.
What changes is that the air blowing out the back of the computer gets hot.
It's pretty... Well, it would be nice. You could put your hands there if it's cold.
And just warm them up.
If you're getting a bomb cyclone,
you just stick them right
It's very
there.
Warm. This is the output. The intake is down here. It's warm, but it's silent. I mean, you really don't hear it.
So there are two huge fans on the inside of that thing blowing out. It's all designed for the thermal capacity all the way up to the 14-core model, right? So it's got a lot of thermal capacity in an iMac.
And while I'm playing the game, I'm still got motion going in the background. I still got browsing going in the background.
Sure.
In fact, let me show you, as long as I'm here, we did a Blackmagic disk test. And this is, I don't know what you use for your speed. I'm not a big benchmark guy. But this is, let's put it this way. Alex Lindsay said, "I've never seen anything peg the Blackmagic speed test."
So the way it works is Apple doesn't actually have an SSD in there. It's got two banks of NAND memory, two NAND memory chips, and then it's got an ARM processor called the T2, which is very much like an iPhone processor, and it does the security on the system. It's also the disk controller. It's the system controller. A lot of things that used to be separate chips are now just run by the T2, and so the T2 is the controller, and it stripes those two NAND banks.
It's amazing,
and they are fast.
And we're still running around in Fortnite while we're doing that. So 3 gigabytes per second disk writes. Why are the reads slower than the writes? That's one thing that kind of puzzled me.
I think it's got to be there's got to be a hardware limitation. I don't know. One of the funny things about SSD is we talked about how SSD is so much faster than a spinning disk.
Right.
But SSD keeps getting faster.
Right.
And the SSD tech keeps improving. This is so much faster than first 5K iMac was.
It's amazing. I've never seen anything like it. And, the good news is, the model I got had a terabyte. How big is your hard drive?
It's
a
terabyte SSD.
So I think they started a terabyte.
Yeah, that's where it starts. That's the base
model. You want a terabyte because you are going to want to put as many of your assets as possible internally.
Yeah, I had a 512 on my previous iMac, and it was Mac, okay, yeah. But I had a RAID system that I would copy using Gigabit Ethernet to get it off.
And it's nice. We've got Thunderbolt 3 off of here, but I don't think, given the speed of the internal drive, I don't think you're going to get any kind of external that runs that
fast.
Yeah,
Thunderbolt 3, though, it can do speed when it needs to, and you can also do, see in the future.
It's probably fast enough for data.
You know, it might be interesting to hang an eGPU off of there or something like that, which you should be able to do.
You could do, right.
So, but yeah, that I think having the internal storage and having it be that fast is a real good thing.
Yeah,
on this
that's system. The thing that particularly blew me away. The screen is marginally better than the 5K iMac screen.
I believe it's the same screen that currently ships on the iMac.
Oh, okay.
Right. The original iMac didn't have the P3 color gamut.
They all do now.
The 2014, but the 15, 16, 17 models all do.
That T2 thing is really interesting. That's an ARM chip.
Yes.
And it's in here as a coprocessor. We thought initially, is it going to be like...
There was a rumor about it, like waking up and checking your email when the main processor was asleep.
That's not the case.
That's not it. It's taking the job of all these other chips that they've kind of like pulled off. It does security. It's encrypting everything on the disk.
That was one thing when we started it up. It starts with unlike any other Mac, File Vault's turned on by default.
Yeah, they want you to turn on File Vault because that means that it's encrypted using your user key as well as the hardware keys. And that means that there's no scenario where somebody could walk away with your computer or walk away with the RAM chips in it that are used as the SSD and get any data off.
But you get encryption for free if you don't turn on File Vault. The T2 is encrypted.
It'll encrypt it without your user key, which means that if somebody walked away with your computer, they could read your data.
Right.
But they couldn't take the chips out of it and read it. And there's no slowdown because it's all... Because the T2 is the disk controller and it's doing the encryption on the fly, like on an iPhone or something like that, it just works. I hate to say it, but it's the advantage of having that ARM, very smart ARM processor running inside there to do all of these tasks.
It's pretty amazing. What else does
the T2? Apple gets it for free because of the iPhone. Essentially, they're using their iPhone.
It's an iPhone chip.
Development. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
So. Could I get Face ID on here or Touch ID at some point?
Face ID requires sensors. Touch ID, if there was an input device, you could because it's got the secure enclave in there.
It does.
It does have that, but it's not using it for any of that. It probably has something to do with using Apple Pay. It's probably using that at some point. It is using the image signal processing that they use
on
the
iPhone.
Let me
show you this. That means you're going to get...
your front-facing camera.
This has, of course, a... 1080p.
Yeah, it's the best front-facing camera ever on an iMac.
You know, normally I would stop some of these, but what the hell? Let's just keep doing things. Let's launch a photo booth and see the image. Now I'm going to come over here. It has face. It's recognizing faces, right?
Yeah. So it's not like Face ID or Windows Hello or something like that. They're not using it for that, but it is doing the thing that the iPhone does. That a lot of good cameras do, which is it knows you are a face in the frame.
So it lights it for this.
It's gonna do the exposure and the white balance and everything else for your face.
It's lighting it for my face.
Yep.
So this is always a problem, especially with Jeff Jarvis, when he's got a very bright background. It will white balance and light for the background because it doesn't know this is a face. But because of the T2 chip, the Apple camera knows where my face is and is actually doing perfect lighting on my face.
Yeah.
This is blown out. But the white balance on my face is perfect. And the lighting on my face is perfect.
Yeah. That's all running through the ARM chip that's on there and then off into the system run by the Intel chip.
Four microphones, so they're obviously thinking, you know, FaceTime or Skype,
well,
right?
Well, and you can do the, you can ask the lady on there. It's the first Mac that you can say, hello, lady.
Hello, hello, lady, you mean Siri.
Yeah, I mean Siri. Yeah. Don't say her name or she appears.
Siri.
But, it'll do that. It'll listen all... You can set it to listen all the time.
The T2's doing that.
And the T2's doing that.
So I could say, hey Shlomo, and it would...
Yeah, if you've got the setting turned on.
I turned it on. I didn't realize I could do that.
And because it's got the microphones, you know, it's actually trying to get a pretty good read on your local audio.
I am going to turn off this disk speed test. You've seen it now, folks. You know that that's what it can do. I don't want to thrash my hard drive, but that's pretty impressive. I'm not going to run Geekbench because you've all seen the Geekbench numbers. They're not going to be any different than anybody else has done.
No, bottom line is it's you want this system if you have an app or apps are incredibly demanding and push the current system that you're using to the limit. It could be a Final Cut render or some other kind of video encode. Those are most of my tests with multi-core stuff. It's twice as fast as my original 4K iMac or 5K iMac, not the latest version, but the original. And so Final Cut, Logic, I use Isotope, which is a denoising program for audio. It's just, for the plugins that are multi-core, it is so much faster. It is shocking.
John says, I have to go. Let's while we're playing this game, which, by the way, we're down to the last 13 players. You start with 100. Let me launch Safari, and we'll just go to fast.com, which is the Netflix speed test, just for fun, to see how fast. Remember, this the Ethernet cable can go to 10 gigabits. We're just plugged into a 1 gigabit switch.
Yawn.
No one knows how we're getting 1.2 gigabits out of it, but that's a nice feeling.
Yeah, and for the 10 gigabit, you're basically on a, like a high-end video
you have
setup
to be a
where
special
you've got
switch.
You
yeah.
need massive yeah. storage that is yeah. like local.
And I love it that all this is going on while this game is going on in the background at the absolute max settings
yeah.
across the board. It's really remarkable.
Well, that's the other way that multi-core benefits you is if you've got no programs that will use more than one core, the system will still put them on separate cores.
It's smart enough to separate.
Yeah,
them
exactly
out.
Right. So you could yeah. run 10 programs that swamp a core all at once.
Well, I'll show you real
for
quickly.
1,000%.
We'll just run HTOP and just real quickly show you that it isn't maxing out any of the processors. Now, this unfortunately doesn't show you GPUs, but you see the right. 20 threads there. There's 10 processors. It's only really using 10 threads at this point, not yeah. all 20 threads, and none of them is even close to maxed out.
And realistically, the GPU is the thing that's going to be drawing the most power.
That's what's doing the game.
It's throwing off the most heat.
Yeah.
I think it's the thing that Apple had to engineer the thermal stuff for more
right.
than the processor is that GPU.
But Fortnite's using a lot of processor, 219% of the processor using 8% of the RAM, but we still are only using 28 of the 64 gigs, which means I bought too much memory.
It's okay. keep that headroom there. One of the funny things about Xeon processors is they don't have the media block that modern consumer Intel processors have to do video encoding,
right.
to do H.264 or H.265.
Oh,
but guess what? The GPU can do that. So Apple sends the
nice.
Video encodes to the GPU instead, and the video encodes are really fast. So
sounds yeah. like Apple's gotten pretty smart about this. Because they make the whole system and the operating system, they can be fairly smart about how they use their hardware. You couldn't do that with use the T2 unless the operating system knew about the T2.
That's their trick, right?
Yeah.
Is they control the hardware, they control the software, and they happen to have been developing ARM chips for a while now for their mobile devices, so why not roll them into the Mac experience? And I this is not going to be... I guess technically the MacBook Pro is the first Mac with an ARM chip because the touch bar is kind of driven by the T1.
Right.
But something like this that's controlling the system and controlling the security of the disk and on boot, it feels to me like this is just the first, and in a few years every Mac will have one of these little ARM buddies running in it doing
it's,
all that
it's,
stuff.
It's pretty pretty impressive. And it's an impressive price. This was as equipped $8,000.
It's a pro system, right? I mean, yeah. the pro. If you'll know if you need it, and you'll know if it's worth it.
Is there anything that can be upgraded at all in here?
The RAM can be upgraded, but it needs to be by an authorized tech, whether it's an Apple Store or somebody else, because it does have just normal RAM modules in there.
Oh,
but you've got to pop off the screen in order to get to
what's,
them.
What's interesting, and there is the iFixit teardown. We tried to get them on, but they were busy. But what's interesting is there's no controller on the RAM.
Yeah,
chip.
It's just bare NAND modules that
so
are controlled
kind of custom,
by the T2.
Custom RAM.
And usually what that means is like, well, can you make a replacement for it? Probably in the next few years, somebody will figure out how to make a swappable replacement for the storage, because
yeah.
that always has happened in the Apple yeah. ecosystem, is that something comes out and it's, oh, it's custom Apple, it can never be duplicated, and then somebody will find a way.
Sure.
Probably, down the
it
road.
It should be actually fairly easy.
The only question is the security, if there's something very specific yeah. that makes it reject non-Apple
yeah.
memory, but it's just a plain old memory, so it should be
they
doable.
They do that with Thunderbolt 3. I have a Kitio Thunderbolt 3 enclosure that's designed for Windows, will not run on this. There is a hack that will turn off system protection.
Yeah, you got to turn off the system integrity protection
yeah,
stuff. Yeah,
SIP gets turned off. But, and I'm not going to do that.
Or they could write a signed kernel extension to do it, right? But
I feel like they could upgrade it. Akitio says, no, we have to make new hardware. So maybe it's in the firmware. Or
maybe
the,
so.
Yeah, maybe they can't change it. Nevertheless, you should be aware if you want to use Thunderbolt 3, you'll need a Thunderbolt 3 enclosure for Macintosh. It's approved for Macintosh. I wanted to see the end of this game. It's been very, very exciting. But I think we're not going to get to it. There are only 8 people left.
Oh, that could take a while because those are the best players.
They're the
right?
best. They're the top 8, the top 8%. Anyway.
Yeah, and this is a computer for the top, not even 8%, 1%. But, like you know, again, don't let your father-in-law buy one. Unless
yeah.
your father-in-law
yeah.
is a professional video
only
editor.
Buy it if yeah right which you may be only buy it if you know you need it. It's really you're not even going to get the fastest Mac depending
if,
on what
if you're
doing.
Using if the Mac you're using now it just is not fast enough for
yeah.
you in all of these ways, multi-core stuff, then that's what it's for.
Coming up, biohacker Josiah Zehner. He's injecting himself. I almost said infecting himself.
Oh, no.
There's a slight difference with modified genes to improve his muscles. But first, Jason Howell's 7 apps and services that can help you keep those resolutions.
Every year we end up here at the starting of January, wondering how on earth we're going to stick to those lofty resolutions that we set for ourselves on New Year's Eve. Well, it's time to pay the piper with our time, and in some cases, our money. Here are a few apps for Android and iOS that might help you stick it to your resolution in 2018. If you hope to finally quit smoking, maybe you should check out Smoke Free. The makers of the app believe that the more context you have as you quit, the more likely you are to stay away. So you'll know how long it's been since your last puff, of course, but perhaps more importantly, the number of cigarettes you haven't smoked, all that money you haven't spent day after day on a pack, health monitoring to know how your body is adjusting over time, and there's even a diary for recording cravings and other frustrations as you go along. Reining in your password health can be a huge chore, particularly because you probably have a ton of accounts with a ton of passwords to manage. I've found that LastPass is an awesome way to take control of your passwords once and for all. You set a master password for the account, and then you let the browser extension or the app on your phone run in the background as you just basically log into your many services and sites as you normally do. And as you do that, that throws those login credentials into your encrypted cloud storage locker. Soon, all of your passwords are organized and protected online. But the best part here is LastPass's security challenge. This is what analyzes your vault of passwords to show you all of those duplicate passwords with direct links to each site so you can make them unique. None of this would be called easy, but it's about as easy as it gets. Take control of your money. That is, get your finances organized by setting up a budget that actually works for you with an app and service that I personally adore called YNAB, which stands for You Need a Budget. YNAB works on the principle that you always budget the money you have, not the money that you expect to have. So you set up your accounts and then construct a monthly budget with the many requirements of your personal finances based on that amount of money that you already have in those accounts. When all is said and done, you'll make purchase decisions based on that money that you've allocated in your budget on a monthly basis instead of, well, guessing. And it makes saving for big purchases a breeze. I swear by YNAB. And now my wife and I look forward to our budget sit downs instead of dreading them. Is 2018 the year that you reduce your smartphone usage? Perhaps the app called Forest will be the motivation you need to do so. The app encourages users to set down the phone to achieve their tasks with a visualization of a forest of trees. In the beginning, your forest is empty, but as you are able to keep from getting distracted on your device for set periods of time, you'll create a healthy tree and then another. As you set new habits and resist your device, you'll be awarded with a healthy forest full of trees that symbolize your success. But if you can't keep to it, those trees will begin to die. If you can't do it for yourself, do it for the trees. And one final thought, if your goal is to get sane in 2018, might I recommend turning off notifications on your device? Or at least prune your apps so you aren't notified to death by all of them at all times. Is now really the best time to know that someone just liked your Facebook post? Is now the best time to see that Target is having a sale on nose hair clippers? All those notifications take you out of the now and bring you back into the phone. Maybe now's the time to focus on what's in front of you in the real world. And reducing your notification spam is one great way to do that. And with that, I wish you the very best in sticking to your goals this year. Here's to a happy and hopefully very fulfilling 2018. I'm Jason Howell, and you'll catch me on All About Android and Tech News Weekly here on twit.tv.
Thank you, Jason. All About Android. Look, here's the king of the Odin project. Odin himself, Josiah Zehner.
Hey, the All-Father. What's up, guys? Great to be here.
The All-Father. The Odin, the-odin.com biohacker. What is a biohacker? Do you like that term?
Yeah, so in order to get the moniker biohacker, it's kind of like Fortnite. You have to defeat 100 other weaker biohackers, and the winner, he gets the term biohacker attached to it.
That can be only one, I understand.
No, actually, it's just kind of like a term we use to describe somebody who's doing science non-traditionally, yeah. So outside of like a big corporation or an academic lab.
But we should explain that you have real credentials, PhD in molecular biology. And biophysics. You worked at NASA for a while. You know, sounds like a boring job, modifying organisms for life on Mars. Not that interesting.
Yeah, my mom, she cried when I left NASA. I had to convince her I was doing
but
something.
But, Mom, I'm not time. Going to Mars. I'm just going to send things to Mars, right?
She was like, why are you leaving
NASA? You know why? Because she could tell her friends, oh, my son works at NASA.
Yeah.
Now she has to say, well... What do you tell your mom?
I think when I was 16, I tried to apply to be an astronaut, and they rejected me. I think she was knew when I was a little kid I wanted to be an astronaut. But now what she tells people that I'm probably crazy.
Well, when I say you ate poop, that really sounds crazy, except you didn't. Exactly. So I just want to start with that because this is something you did a while ago.
Yeah, right? No, it's an interesting topic, and I think it gets back to the whole, like, biohacker thing. So biohacking, I kind of look at it as a way to hack biology, right? So it's like...
I think it's the new frontier,
yeah,
obviously, right?
Totally.
With CRISPR, genetic modification, this is what's happening.
Yeah, so I grew up in, like, the computer hacker movement in the late 90s, early 2000s. Might have gone a little before that, depending on who you were. And people were just, you know, there's all this information available on the internet that people could read, learn. You know, I taught myself how to program computers.
It was really exciting.
Yes.
I remember those days,
oh,
the Homebrew Computer Club. I remember, you know, talking to Kevin Mitnick, and he talked about dumpster diving for phone manuals. It was exciting.
Yeah.
But this is the next thing.
Yeah.
Is there really that same spirit?
So when you look back at, like, computers and... You know, when the personal computer revolution came around, it was like computers were only for people in big companies.
Right. Like IBM was what computers were.
Yeah, the
before
mainframe.
The home computers.
And you had to have an air-conditioned facility with a raised floor. You couldn't have your own computer.
Yeah, and the programming languages, you know, maybe it was really hard to learn.
Punch cards. Fortran, COBOL.
Yeah. Yeah, and biology has kind of been that same way, right? Where it's like...
Yes, you have to be Genentech.
Yeah.
Or NASA.
Yeah, or, you know, a well-funded university to do this stuff. And now the prices are starting to drop. The knowledge is starting to get out there. And you get a lot of people in their homes who are trying to, you know, hack stuff, experiment on their own, and try to figure out new ways in which they can solve problems that, you know, the world can't because there's not enough, you know... There's not enough throughput.
Can you really do serious work, though, without having a big lab and a big institution?
Oh, totally. The thing is that a lot of the stuff I did at NASA, I can do in a lab that probably costs, you know, $5,000.
No kidding.
I mean, obviously, there's equipment that costs a lot of money and experiments that cost a lot of money. A lot of stuff like that you can outsource to other people right now. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the prices on that stuff will probably drop also, but... Yeah, it's totally cool, the stuff you can do, really, to, like, engineer organisms, you know, bacteria, yeast, things like that. Everybody's playing around with.
Even fecal plants. Transplant's about bacteria, right?
Yeah.
We all have a biome. It's a big mass in our stomach of bacteria. That's what helps us digest, but it impacts our health, even our mental health, in all sorts of ways that we're just learning about.
Yeah, it's all over our body, you know? That's what I was talking about, like, the computer thing. I don't think we're like computers, but the kind of hacking thing you can think about, right? We're covered in bacteria. It's all on us and in us.
Yeah.
Right? Everywhere.
We couldn't live without it.
Yeah, we're like this symbiotic being, you know? There's probably an old Star Trek character or something that looked like, oh.
Bacteria, man. E. coli, man. Yeah, so you ate poop? I'm sorry, I keep getting back to that.
Wow.
But you can't bring it up and then not talk about it, right?
You can introduce new bacteria into your biome and change the way your body processes.
A much better way to put it.
Exactly, yeah, it's really interesting. Well, and one of the things I like to say is that I'm so glad that eating poop is not the thing I'm most well known for.
It's going to be.
Despite Leo's attempts.
Yeah. But did it help? You were having gut problems.
Yeah, so I was having gut problems, IBS gut problems, and like a lot of people experience
this
stuff.
Oh, it's the worst.
It's the worst. A lot of people where you're going to the bathroom all the time.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Gross stuff like blood in your stool.
And you don't feel good, most importantly. You just feel crappy.
Yeah, and so, you know, there have been a lot of experiments on this stuff. A lot of it's, you know, when you start to get to medical experiments on humans, even ones that are, you know, relatively safe.
They're big ethical issues.
Yeah, there's a lot of ethical stuff behind it. So people are kind of like, oh, you know, we haven't run a clinical trial on this stuff yet. But there was a lot of promising research on it.
And many of the biggest medical breakthroughs have come from scientists experimenting on themselves. This is a well-known common process.
Yeah, it's to push those boundaries, right? It's when a scientist sees that there's evidence to support an experiment, right?
Yeah.
I kind of view all the stuff I do kind of like, you know, more engineering.
Interesting.
So you like shoot a rocket up to space or something, and maybe it blows up on the first time, right? But you expect to try again.
Yes.
Right? So these experiments, I
usually
see the
though,
same way.
The rocket isn't you, and you're not blowing up. That's why it's a little, but you know what you're doing. It helped your IBS, by the way.
Oh, yeah, seriously. Like, I can't believe.
We're not recommending this as a personal process.
We
you
actually
can read more about it on
I actually did,
website.
Yeah. Scientific experiments, you know, like, purified the DNA from the bacteria before and after, sent it off to a national lab and had them look at the changes.
So you know what you're doing.
Don't try this
at home, folks. So let's talk about CRISPR, because CRISPR has been a big breakthrough in genetic modification.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, CRISPR's pretty crazy. It's, you know, the hot genetic modification topic. And if you want to talk, it's probably like the JavaScript of 1999. Was JavaScript?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So it's early days.
Yeah.
But it allows you to effectively cut gene sequences from one DNA strand and put it into another DNA strand. Is that right?
Oh,
it's like cut and paste for DNA.
Kind of, yeah, totally. So personally, you know, I'm more of a Perl kind of guy, Perl programming.
Good man. Good man. Larry Wall would approve.
I've been all old school and, you know, at NASA and stuff. And before I
they
did.
Use Perl at NASA?
Tell oh, no, me I don't know.
True. I hope not.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm talking about the genetic engineering.
All the great astronomy stuff is.
Fourth. It's all done in fourth. That's okay.
Python. I don't understand. Well, no, so like I compare CRISPR to like the Python, and I was doing all the stuff in Perl in genetic engineering. And I was like, you know,
I get it.
Plotting along, doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it was like good, but it didn't work.
You were doing recombinant DNA in the old school stuff.
Yeah, and then I learned about this CRISPR stuff, and I was like, wow, that's pretty awesome. Except it uses white spaces instead of curly brackets, so it took me a while to understand.
Four spaces or a tab? Which, anyway, no, let's not go into that. Let's not go there. So you've been able to, actually, I know you crowdsourced kind of a do-it-yourself CRISPR lab, kind of?
Yeah, so my goal with all the stuff I do is not only to help myself, but it's kind of to bring access to people.
Wow.
Right? So I want people to be able to have access to this, you know, science and genetic engineering stuff that they haven't had before. Because it's like, you hear all this stuff, you read about it in the news, and they're like, yeah, you know, maybe we'll see it in 10 or 20 years. And I'm kind of an impatient person, you know?
All good hackers are, yeah.
Like, who was talking about the apps? Jason on there, and he said, like, you know, turn off your notifications. You know, it's me. I'm like, notification, oh, my gosh. You know?
So listen to him, because obviously you're going to get less done if you do that all the time. So tell me what kinds of things you can do. The CRISPR that you were selling was not for modifying yourself.
No. So we don't sell things directly for people to be able to modify themselves.
No.
You know, with enough knowledge.
This is more like a chemistry kit that you can learn about it.
Yeah. Right? So this kind of gives people an introduction to genetic modification of organisms.
Nice.
And then if they want to do, you know, more complicated experiments, they can learn. So it's kind of like an introduction to programming or something. You know, when you do an introduction to programming and they're like, all right, you know, type in these
stuff. It's the hello world for genetic engineering.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah. It's kind of like the hello world for genetic engineering. So where people can like learn how to do this stuff. And they have example experiments, so they don't need to come up with it on their own.
Would you say a smart high schooler could do this?
Oh, totally. Yeah, we've sold kits to high schoolers. We sold kits to, you know, colleges, universities.
Wow, that's cool.
everybody.
THE-ODIN.com if you want to take a look at these.
Yeah, we try to make them. You don't have to have any experience to use these kits. That's what we want it to be, right? We want to break down the barriers that's stopping people from getting involved in genetic. Because, you know, it is kind of the future, right? You have all this AI stuff and you have all this stuff. And I think genetic engineering is the other big thing that's going to, like, really change technology.
So you are doing stuff to yourself, though, with CRISPR.
Yeah. You know, here's the thing is there have been technologies like CRISPR, similar, and they've taken 10 or 15 years to reach human beings, right?
Yeah.
And not because they weren't safe or things like that. It's just because, you know, maybe there wasn't enough money invested in it. Maybe people weren't interested enough. Maybe they didn't see the companies didn't see how they could make money. And hearing all this promise of CRISPR and seeing, you know, how great it is, like, it's slow getting out there. You know, every 2 years, companies are like, well, 2 years, we're going to have something out there.
But that's understandable. From a company and a governmental point of view, that's understandable.
Yeah, no, it totally is, right?
That's appropriate. In fact, this is illegal in some countries to do this to yourself.
Oh,
right?
I mean, in some countries, it's illegal to even, you know, mix DNA with any type of organism.
Right. They're scared. Germany, a good example. They're terrified. But now, what about
Germany
in the U.S.?
Can actually go to jail for using some of our kits.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad.
Go to jail.
Wow. So no, don't buy, in the US, not available in Germany.
In the U.S., they're pretty lenient on these things because, you know, they look at what harm these, you know, the organisms that are engineered can cause.
Right.
And they've determined that the harm is, you know, basically nothing.
You're confident that this isn't going to create some, you know, terrible monster that's going to get loose or a disease or anything like that. You're not worried about that.
Actually, I'm kind of hoping I create the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
What did you inject?
I was trying to you
injected
in one. Really
intramuscularly.
I love pizza.
You injected a modified gene. What was it to do?
Yeah, so what I was trying to do was, you know, I was trying to push this CRISPR thing forward. I kind of view it like the 4-minute mile, right? Nobody could run the 4-minute mile until somebody did.
Here's video of you doing this, you insane person.
And then when somebody ran that 4-minute mile, right, all of a sudden everybody else was breaking that barrier.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, let me see what I can do. So, you know, I read the scientific literature, looked at clinical trials, looked at experiments that other people were doing, and found out, like, wow, there's stuff that I can do for inexpensive.
Wow.
And test it out on myself.
Let's just see what happens.
Yeah. You know, and I looked, you know, it is, but I looked at the safety. You know, like, obviously, I'm not trying to hurt myself or
anything
like that.
But you're a little bit of a risk taker? You're kind of living with the idea that it might have made you sick? Or you feel confident that it's safe?
I'm actually not too big of a risk taker.
Good.
Your mom will be happy to hear that.
So when I, you know, maybe when I was a kid, but I had this one bad, you know, experience when I tried to jump, you know, jump off this cliff into some water and I slipped. And I was like, never again.
Ooh.
Never doing anything risky ever again after that.
Good.
And now the riskiest thing I did was walk through the Tenderloin.
That's risky. Don't do that again. That is risky.
But no, so I looked at the safety on this stuff and, you know, based on the data out there, and, you know, I try to trust the science. As much as I trash talk it, but, you know, I try to trust it. And it seemed that it would be no more, you know, harmful to me than, say, smoking a cigarette or something like that. So I decided to try to trust the science. And
what did you think might happen?
So the goal of the experiment was to actually use CRISPR to modify a gene in my body called myostatin. Now, this gene, it prevents muscle from growing in your body, kind of like, if your muscle was growing all the time, you would take up so many calories. You'd have to just eat constantly, right? But you look jacked.
Yeah.
Maybe a good trade-off right there.
Might be worth it. Look, here's a dog. This is from your website.
Yeah, exactly.
On the left, no myostatin.
On the right, just a normal dog. That's we're all on the right, right?
Yeah. I want to look like the dog on the left. How do I do that?
No, yeah, it wasn't so much that I wanted muscle. It was just like a good proof of concept. They've shown this worked in other animals.
What would be the test to see if it worked? You would test your own DNA?
Yeah, so there's a couple different tests. Like, obviously, you can try to see if your muscle gets jacked. I injected just a small intramuscular region.
You weren't trying to get beefed up.
So if I saw something, you know, unknown, the other thing you do is you, you know, purify your DNA from your body.
And so it's your own DNA.
Yeah, you test it and see.
And
if
you wrapped
it
in a polymer that would allow that DNA to invade existing cells and modify their DNA, which is wild. It really means you could inject new DNA that would change some cells.
Yeah, so this is actually done a lot. You know, there have been like over 400 clinical trials in the U.S. that have used similar techniques. So it's not something that's just like, I wish I was a genius and came up with this all on my own, but I'm just kind of copying everybody else. The thing that I did was I attempted to use CRISPR, which nobody else has attempted to do in a human.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We are really on the brink of something, aren't we?
I really think we are. You know, it really reminds me of the early days of the internet, right? BBS, AOL.
Those were fun times. I remember those days.
And, like, everybody could feel it. When you went on, I remember the first time I went online, like, you could just feel it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, first time online, I think it was in a Star Trek role-playing chat room on AOL.
Yeah.
Sounds like the internet.
Yeah. And I was like, whoa, this is so awesome. Yeah.
You remember that, right, Jason?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We've all experienced that the first time.
Yeah, and that I was thinking about 30 years ago when I was on a computer BBS, right?
Yeah.
And you learn the rules and you learn how to communicate. And you also get that sense that eventually everybody's going to figure this out and it's going to change the world, which it now has, right? Like now
and
everybody's
now
on the internet.
We want to do something nobody else is doing. Let's find something new.
Right.
You want to inject some CRISPR, Jason?
No, thank you. I'll wait for the home game.
I'll tell you what. I'll inject the CRISPR. You eat the poop, okay?
No. All right.
No,
sounds good.
What do you want to do next? What's your next experiment?
I don't know. I'm really just focused on getting stuff out to people, like DNA literacy. I want people to understand how this stuff works. Just like, I never took a computer class, and I'm sure most people nowadays never took a computer
self-taught
class, right?
Yep.
You had a computer in front of you, you used it, you learned how to use it by getting your hands, you know, dirty with it. And I think the same thing can happen with DNA and genetic engineering. We get this stuff out to people, you know, people can learn how to use it, experiment with it, and, you know, then we have our next generation of scientists and medical doctors who are just way beyond what any of us could do right now.
So it's in effect, the Apple One of genetics. You can go to the-odin.com, pick yourself up an Apple One. You know what? Get two, save one so you can sell it for $1 million in 30 years.
Yeah.
And use the
Don't open it up.
You've got everything
new
in
box.
You can create your own whole lab, right, with all this stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, we actually sell, like, whole lab kits to people.
I love this.
For, I think it's around $2,000. So
you can just build a lab and start messing around with it.
Yeah, start doing molecular biology and genetic engineering in your home. And it's totally legal. You know, we don't sell anything
Except
to
in
anybody.
Germany. Don't do it in Germany. Okay.
Yeah, we try to just get it out to people so they can do stuff.
I think this is great. Fascinating stuff. Josiah, I really appreciate your coming by. Josiah Zehner is a biohacker, the CEO at the-odin.com. His Twitter account, the number 4, LOV of science.
For love of science.
Who doesn't? We love science. Thank goodness for science. And, you know, if you think back, I can think about so many times that scientists wanted to do human experimentation, but, you know, that's difficult. So they did it to themselves. And a lot of the advances that we have came from scientists who were willing to do that. So
Nobel prizes and everything.
Nobel prizes.
Not that I hope to be up there. You know, I just want to push things forward a little bit.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you, Josiah. I really appreciate
it was great
you coming
to be
by.
Here.
It's very nice to meet you. Oh my God, you're strong.
Yeah.
It's time for a call for help. Thank you, Josiah. Let's get on over to the set here because we have on the line all the way from Virginia. James is on the Skype. Hello, James.
Hello.
Thanks for hanging out with us. We appreciate it. Sorry we took so long to get to you, but I appreciate your patience. We were talking before. You've got these great, what are these lights? They're underneath the Tchaikovsky portrait over your shoulder there.
Yeah, new acquisition. Or lights and happiness.
Oh, look at that. See?
It's doing stuff.
Yeah, they're changing.
I love that stuff.
I think they're called the Nanoleaf.
Nanoleaf. Wow.
And, of course, it's all on an app. And
you can change it? Oh, nice.
Yeah. You can change it. And
it's
got a microphone module, and you can make it like you're at the club, and it pulses to the music and
now,
all that.
Initially, I thought that might be a beer stein on your headboard there, but I think it's something. What is that?
It's a Toy Story alien, right?
It's a Toy Story alien?
That's the alarm clock with, sure, yep, the Toy Story alien sticker.
You recognize it, Jason.
I know that claw, it moves.
It lights up for, you know, waking you up. I like my lights.
This is the best bedroom. And look at he's got the Lambda from Half-Life behind him, and I think you're a serious... Do you do a podcast? I notice you have a Yeti microphone there.
No podcast. I was wondering if you're going to ask me, do I do a podcast? No.
No. Well, no, you think
one of these days everybody will.
Everybody.
So you'll get there.
Everybody needs
everyone
a podcast.
Everyone already has, haven't they? Yeah.
Pretty close.
Unfortunately.
You're the last one, so get on it.
Get on it. All right. So what can we do for you?
Yeah, I was wondering about... I know battery health and battery technology has been a topic of interest with... our iPhones and our laptops. My question is more about maybe health of our file systems, our SSDs, our hard drives. I run a late 2013 Apple MacBook Pro, so not brand new, not too old, but you know, with the High Sierra update, you know, did the big file change over to the Apple file system, and that's running okay. I'm on it now, and nothing's on fire, but definitely some strangeness. And, you know, with Jason on and you know, wondering about, you know, how's that going for everyone?
Your timing is good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, remember, so Apple's file system, HFS, has been around for 20 years, right?
Yeah,
almost 30.
Yeah, HFS Plus came out like in 98 or something.
That's
like
ancient.
That. And then the first major change to it, to Apple's file systems, was last year with APFS, the Apple file system.
And I remember there was a rumor briefly that Apple was going to use ZFS, so the Sun slash
Oracle. Yeah, they started
Oracle.
Working on it, and then it just didn't.
And I was really excited because ZFS is a modern, what they call a COW file system.
Yeah.
Copy on write.
Shocker, Apple decided to write their own instead.
Why not?
Who knew?
Let's do it.
Very
so
Apple.
What is different about this file system compared to HFS?
Well, it's a completely new file system. It's got a bunch of different stuff in it. It's got the ability to take snapshots.
That's one feature I loved in ZFS. In effect, you could say, remember this position and roll back.
Yeah.
Now, is APFS doing that now?
It's doing that in a very limited way in High Sierra. So it's every iOS device is running APFS now. And if you upgraded to High Sierra on a Mac that only has an SSD, not a spinning disk or a fusion drive, right, you got updated to APFS.
Right. And is it, when does it take snapshots? When you install something?
It's taking snapshots for the local backup, which is this weird concept where you can basically roll back to a previous version of a document that you're working on,
right,
in apps that support it.
How do you do that? It's in the app.
It actually, it's like it's a part of Time Machine,
okay,
but it's basically a local Time Machine,
okay,
that's just for sort of document
ultimately
versioning.
This could be System Restore on steroids. It would
yeah,
roll you back to any particular time.
And there's some apps that use it now. Some of the backup apps try to take a snapshot, mm-hmm, now, and they're using it. It's not in Time Machine yet, although it probably will be
next
year.
Well, and the irony is you can't use an APFS disk for Time Machine.
Yeah, it's too early. I mean, you get the sense that Time Machine is a logical place for it to go, but it's not there yet.
Yeah.
The biggest place you see it in High Sierra is if you try to make a copy of a file, it's instantaneous now because it can have two separate sets of pointers to the same space,
right,
on disk. So when you copy something, it's instantaneous, and then when you change it, then it diverges and it writes out.
James, do you use solid state disks in your Mac, or are you still on a spinning disk?
It's solid state flash.
So you got upgraded without, basically that was not a choice. You upgraded to High Sierra, so your disk went to APFS.
Yeah, and you probably did that upgrade to that 2013 MacBook. I did it to my 2015. I went to Otherworld Computing and bought a replacement SSD. That really sped things up. But the other reason for APFS is HFS doesn't know from solid state.
Right, and the APFS was built basically for SSDs, and it understands about how SSDs are engineered and how they're not like spinning disks. And the issues with aging SSDs are not the same issues as with aging spinning disks and all of those.
So trim and things like that are automatic.
Right.
It does everything better for an SSD, so your SSD is going to last longer, be more reliable, that kind of thing.
Right.
Faster,
that's,
too.
That's the idea.
Yeah, yeah. There are concerns, obviously. You mentioned one, which is it won't install APFS on spinning drives.
Right.
Will it install it on external SSDs? Can you? I think I'll answer.
I think
that
you can
question.
Use the disk utility to format something as APFS.
Exactly.
But what Apple won't do is forcibly upgrade
right.
you. Only that right. internal SSD gets forcibly upgraded right. to APFS.
If you have a RAID array, it will not allow you to do APFS
correct.
On the RAID array. So it's early days.
It's early days.
But APFS is stable right now.
Yeah.
As it stands.
I mean, Apple released it for iOS. Last spring, they basically upgraded every single iOS device to APFS in a standard update, which is pretty wild. And it turns out they actually were testing it where they were doing updates on previous versions, where they were doing a conversion and then rolling out of it just to see if it worked.
See if anybody screamed bloody murder.
And it worked.
Apple doesn't get enough credit for that. And this happened with iOS 10 or 11.
APFS, it was like 10.2, I want to say.
So all of a sudden, everybody with an iPad and iPhone, without their knowledge, without even really it looking, it was just non-spectacular. We all got APFS.
Right. It's easier on iOS where you don't actually see the file system. It's
right.
hidden from you.
Right.
But yeah, it just happened. They did
it's
a whole
amazing.
File system upgrade on you know tens of millions, hundreds of millions of devices.
So if you're running High Sierra and you have a solid state drive, you should do APFS, right?
Well, it will make you.
You don't have a choice.
You don't have a choice.
Okay.
I wouldn't go out of my way to create an APFS drive, but you should know that if you're running an SSD internally on a Mac and you go to High Sierra, you are going to be on a new file system.
And one thing you'll see immediately that's really weird about APFS, if you look at an APFS disk, it's a container with a volume
yeah.
in it, and you can make new volumes.
Yeah, so one of the other concepts in APFS is virtual volumes. So instead of creating a partition where you've got a 1 terabyte drive and you create a 500 gig partition and another 500 gig partition, you can create essentially an unlimited number of virtual volumes, and they all share the same space.
They're the same size.
Which is great because it means that you can fit a terabyte on a terabyte drive and instead of having these two partitions and hitting 500 gigs on one and being done, and the other one's empty, and it says, sorry, I'm full over here. With APFS, it just will dynamically, it just keeps using the existing space on the drive. So essentially, these are like virtual partitions.
And they'll grow and use whatever they need.
As necessary, exactly right. But it does mean that it looks totally different where
it's
you've
bizarre.
Got these containers and things like that.
I've got 2 1-terabyte drives on my terabyte physical drive.
Right, until you use it up. And that's
right.
that along with another concept, which I think James mentioned too, which is what is free space on a disk that's running High Sierra and APFS? Starting with Sierra, Apple totally redefined what free space is. So now free space doesn't just mean free space on your drive. It also means stuff that the system thinks is deletable because it doesn't actually need to keep it around.
So I have 3 volumes on one drive, and they're all a terabyte.
Yeah,
it's very strange.
Right.
Yeah.
But you couldn't copy 3 terabytes on there.
No.
Because if you copied a terabyte on one, they'd all fill
yes.
up, essentially.
Yeah.
It's different.
How would you use this partitioning scheme? I haven't really wrapped my head around it. It's a way of segregating data?
Yeah, if you wanted to keep data on separate volumes, you no longer have to have them be the exact fixed size. You can have them be whatever size you want.
I have 2 volumnes.
Congratulations.
I misspelled one, so I thought I
misspelled. I saw that spelling.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
good.
It's a new way to spell
That's
volume. Volumne. But you can actually rename it, which is good.
So, James, you noticed weird free space warnings, right?
Things like, part of it to jump to the end, it ends up me not being as good as keeping enough elbow room, enough free space on. So I'm guilty of...
solve that. If you run out of space, you run out of space,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. But I'll put out a warning or a heads up, and I guess it's just common general knowledge. You know, keep your free space in your elbow room, but once it gets below a certain point, and I do a good job of getting it back, but definitely some strangeness after you are under the 5 gigs, 2 gigs.
That makes sense. It may right. need more slack space than a traditional HFS volume just because of the copy on write features, the snapshot. Remember, snapshots take space.
So,
and all of this stuff is kind of
virtual memory.
And
maybe.
The other thing that's happening here is there's this purgeable concept. So ideally what happens is when you get below a certain threshold and Apple has processes working in the background, when you get below a certain threshold, it's looking at what it can throw away. And that's things like caches. That could be your photos that you've got in a photos library that are also in iCloud. It'll actually just go ahead and delete those unless you have specifically told it not to do that. There's a bunch of stuff that is just marked as purgeable space.
The disk management kind of helpers that they've added to clear up your trash can, clear up your...
Right. They want to help you in all of those ways because, yeah, when you get below a certain level of free space, it is a problem. But it has more latitude. The system has more latitude than it used to. If you do iCloud document sync, it's the same thing. You can have – if you've got documents that are synced with iCloud, it knows that they're in the cloud. So if you need to free up space, it should do that automatically if there's stuff that it considers purgeable.
Yeah, like place markers. Yeah, when I first did the upgrade, which has been a few months now, there was a scary moment, and I wrote it in like images of folders of images, and they were just blank.
Yeah.
Like, okay. And then eventually they populated and filled in, like, okay, is it indexing? Is it still converting these to the new file system?
So that
was a bit of a scary moment.
They're all converted, but I have found, and I think there's some bugs going on here too, I have found that the Finder in High Sierra, sometimes when the first time you were looking at a volume, it's not reliable.
It'll show you
a blank folder.
I see that all the time.
And then like 2 minutes later, it will populate. Or it'll show you a folder that goes, if it's sorted by name, it'll go from like A to H, and then the rest of it isn't there. Yeah. And it's terrifying because you think you've just lost everything, and then you wait a minute.
So be patient.
And it continues to
fill
in.
And that won't happen again, by the way. It's going to cache it.
Because it caches it, right? But it initially doesn't cache it.
It is. You know what? We have to get used to it. It's these COW file systems, like ZFS and BTRFS, which is widely used now in Unix, and of course APFS, are completely different beasts.
Right, and they're better in a lot of ways. But all of our innate assumptions about like how a computer works and how files
work, we have to relearn it all.
Are not assumptions you can make for these systems.
So if I create an alias, is it the same or is it doing something different now?
I think the alias is the same because it's basically like a Unix link. The difference is that if you make a duplicate, it's more like a hard link was back
in the
day
on Unix.
Isn't that
funny? So you duplicate it, but you're not taking more space. You're only making a hard link to
exactly it. Right.
Yeah.
And that's good for things like backups because you don't need to make a copy of that file.
Right.
You just point to the original, and then at some point if the file changes, then the file system handles that it's a new version.
It's kind of magical.
Yeah, and that's how it should be. And so yes, if you've got a 2 gigabyte file on your Mac in High Sierra running APFS and you do Command D to duplicate it, it just is instantaneous.
It's wild because it's just making a link.
Right. But if you open it and save it, it'll save it out as a, and then it'll take up more space on your disk. But from your perspective, it's two different files, and that's again, file systems didn't used to work that way, but that's how they work now.
Well, and I'm really looking forward to a rewrite of Time Machine to take advantage of APFS, because Time Machine, frankly, is a clunky, kludge hack.
It's a hack with hard links and other weird stuff going on, and it should be, my hope is that the next version of Mac OS is just going to take the old Time Machine and replace it with a new APFS-focused Time Machine where it's just doing, it's able to take snapshots and record those out and then only update what's changed, and it'll be much more efficient.
It'd be a miracle.
Yeah. It's amazing it works as it is because they're using every trick in the book to get that thing to work.
Be honest, I never used Time Machine. I told people not to because it is such a hack. But I turned it on here because I'm hoping to see it converted to an APFS snapshot system.
One day.
Someday, magically.
Right now it's just the local ones, but I think I'm hopeful that that'll happen. And apps like SuperDuper and Carbon Copy Cloner are all now starting to support snapshots as well, and it can have a big benefit for them when they're writing out to a backup and they only need to take a new snapshot.
I'm a longtime user of SuperDuper and I can't wait to see what he does using it.
Yeah, he's got starting down that path now, it's also scary for those developers because APFS isn't really documented.
It's like completely undocumented.
Apple is kind of like, we're rolling it out, but really don't ask any questions.
I don't know if they know what it's doing.
Well, I think they know exactly what it's doing, but they don't want sort of to disseminate it too much.
I think five guys know what
they're
doing.
They're taking it slow.
And the rest are going, ask Joe.
He invented it.
James, I'm so glad you called. This is actually a topic I've been wanting to hear about from Jason, so I'm really glad you asked this question.
Thanks.
Did we answer all your questions?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
Really nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Jason and Leo.
Thank you.
Thank you. James from Virginia. I couldn't be happier. I wanted a primer on this. I've been playing with it. I think that, you know, when you get a new computer, this is the time to try the new technologies.
Sure.
And it's really interesting.
I mean, it's meant to be
watch.
Invisible, but once you're, you know, getting a little bit nerdy, right, and you open the disk utility and you notice, oh, wait a second.
Wait,
if you click that partition button, it really gets weird because it says,
it
do you want to do a real partition or one of our fake partitions?
It completely confused me.
Right? Because
it's like, what?
Which one do I want? Because for boot camp, you need a real partition.
Yeah.
But for Mac stuff, you can just do a fake partition.
If you want to be confused, read this. Apple File System Space Sharing. APFS volumes share storage space with a container occupying a single partition. Adding and deleting APFS volumes is faster and simpler than editing a partition map. Would you like to add a volume, or do you really want to partition this?
What? It's a new world. This is just like if you do about this Mac and you look at what your storage is, and there's this big block that is purgeable space. You're like, well, wait a second. What does that mean? And are you counting that as free space? Which they are. That's the secret, is that they call that free space.
I see 8.91 gigabits purgeable. Does that mean I should empty that? What is that?
Purgeable
that's
means that
the trash.
If it... No, that's stuff that it considers deletable on... if it needs to. So if your disk fills up, the first thing it will do when it gets close to being full is wipe out that 8 gigs of purgeable stuff.
Okay.
Because it knows it either isn't important or it can be downloaded from the cloud.
And this is something that particularly takes advantage of SSDs. This is kind of...
Purgeable's on everything. And that's the idea that Apple wants to start building into the operating system, this concept of... And iOS has this too. The idea that some stuff can be deleted. Like your photos is the best example. Your photo library, if you're not storing all your photos locally... Yeah. But every time you click on one, it downloads it, and it gets bigger and bigger. Your iTunes library is like that. And the idea is, now I have no space left. What do I do? Well, I don't need to save these song files because they're all up in the cloud. I don't need to save these photos. They're all in the cloud. I'll just delete them, and then we'll just keep on doing our job. Yeah.
I should have looked, but did I create and now have two non-mounted volumes that I don't know anything about, or was that from...
Actually, that's another thing that I think James might have mentioned. Yeah, there's secret volumes that are in there, including the rescue, what used to be the rescue partition, which I now think is a volume. And sometimes that's actually how a boot camp install works, is that they write to a secret volume and then reboot into that and then continue your Windows installation.
But you can't really turn those on.
No, and they're meant to be invisible. And there's, you know, maybe there's an EFI, like a boot partition, too. And the Mac has had invisible disk partitions for a while, but now with APFS, they can do them as these sort of virtual partitions, which is good because if it turns out later that the rescue partition needs to be a little bit bigger, they don't have to resize it now because it just is using the same shared space as the rest of your disk.
You bet.
So it's weird.
I recognize
all the rules we learned about disks are gone.
I was refreshing my old Mac. And I erased the hard drive, and then normally when I would at that point say I'm going to install the operating system, it downloads it. It did it right away, and I thought, where'd it get that from?
Hidden. Secret partition.
Secret.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows it's there except now you do. Padre is going to be with us next week. He's going to CES this week. We'll have his report. Lots to talk about. And if you have a question for our resident maker and the quad father, here's how you ask.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
Hi, I'm doing the downward dog.
Doing some yoga there?
Hi. It's time to learn some yoga poses. Megan Maroney is here with our favorite new app for the stretching set.
New year, new you. You've heard it before. It's only the first week of January. It is not too late. Talk to me in February. By then, it will be too late. But not now. Call them resolutions, New Year's intentions, whatever. I have three of them. One, save money. Two, exercise every day. And three, calm the bleep down. And I have one app that will accomplish all three. It's called Yoga Studio. Number one, how I save money. I canceled my $100 a month Yoga Studio membership and replaced it with a Yoga Studio membership on my iPad, iPhone, and Apple TV, which is only $20 a year. That's less than $2 a month, so that's a savings of nearly $1,200, not to mention the gas and the wear and tear on my car getting to the Yoga Studio, which also, by the way, charged me $1 every time I forgot my mat or my towel. Number two, you can use the Yoga Studio app on your iPad, your iPhone, your Apple TV, so it's perfect for a regular practice in your living room or to take it wherever you go. The key to resolutions is to make them easy. So if you have time for 10 minutes of yoga, there's a class for that. Some exercise is always better than no exercise at all. You can create your own classes and create a schedule for your classes and then sync them with your calendar. And number three, yoga helps me calm down. The strength and balance classes are great for, well, strength and balance, but there's also deep relaxation, guided meditation, and all the other stuff that helps me slow down and counteract the 7 cups of coffee I feel like I need every day. You can try Yoga Studio for free for 2 weeks on your iPhone or your iPad. It's also available on Android, Amazon, and Windows, so you can practice with your Kindle, your Microsoft Surface, and even your Windows phone. You have no excuses. I am Megan Maroney, and you can see all my iOS app reviews on iOS Today, where we put out a new episode every Tuesday. I also host Tech News Weekly every Thursday with Jason Howell. And if you have questions or you want help keeping your resolutions, your intentions, or whatever, you can find me at Megan Maroney on Twitter.
Thank you, Ms. Yoga Poser. Oh. I know, just looking at it.
I like that Megan is on that story.
I have a
we are not.
Fairly controversial opinion that yoga's for women, not men.
Oh, boy.
No, but...
Talk to Bikram about that.
Exactly.
He's going to...
And Iyengar and the great yoga masters, they're all men, but I don't understand it because my body doesn't turn and twist that way. I'm just saying.
Maybe it's just not for you.
Maybe I shouldn't say men. I should say fat men.
All right, the fat man will allow you to speak to them.
The fat man says, no yoga for me, but it is time for the mailbag.
Mailbag, not a bag. Again, I'll point out.
It's not a bag.
But it's great.
Box. And it needs to do some yoga. It's getting creaky in its old age. Oh, look at this. Where did that come from?
Oh, I have a deck of Tech TV playing
cards. Is that yours,
cards.
Jerry? Oh.
Yeah.
You do?
I do.
I didn't get any of this crap.
I do. My kids don't know what it is.
Is that your card?
Yes, okay. That is my card. How did you know?
Have I just completely depreciated the value of the cards?
They are not mint in box anymore.
Not mint in box anymore. But you know what is mint in this box? Some brand new
letters.
Just give me one.
All right.
Share. Okay. Who gets number one?
Well, that's you.
I do. Hi, new screensavers.
Hey.
Is there any... Oh, no, this question's for you.
I'll read you. All right.
Is there any way to back convert the existing photos on my iOS devices to HEIF, the new high efficiency image format?
Yes.
To save space. Also, is there any performance impact using HEIF and HEVC, that's the video version of HEIF,
right,
on my older devices, Dave?
Well, older devices may not be able to
read
use
HEIF
hardware. Well, if you have to be on High Sierra or iOS 11 to read HEIF or HEVC. And older devices may not have the hardware to support encoding and decoding.
In other words, don't.
And it'll be slower. But yeah, the truth here is... The answer to the question is yes. There's software
there
you can
HEIF
download
converts.
That will convert your JPEGs to HEIF.
HEIF and what, kits, if you will.
If you want to, sure. Or cats named HEIF Cliff.
HEIF Cliffs.
Here's a piece from iMore.
Renee says, it's a bad idea.
It is. You will save a little bit of space, but first off, HEIF is lossy. JPEG is lossy. So you'll be taking a lossily encoded file and then re-lossily encoding it. You probably won't notice the quality difference, but the fact is you're potentially degrading the quality of your image for a little bit of space savings. Plus, if you're syncing with any cloud service, it's going to get really confusing. There's going to be a question about if you can keep your metadata or not. When you change, it may lose track of like when
Google,
your files were
Google
taken.
Google Photos now seems to understand the HEIF format pretty well. We should say it's not just an Apple format.
But
it's a standard.
It's a standard. Apple's just trying to help popularize it, and it
is
a great
should.
Format.
Yeah.
I would say if you've got everything running iOS 11 and High Sierra, you should definitely start taking photos.
From now on, everything
everything's going to be in HEIF and HEVC for videos. Probably. But I wouldn't go back. I would really not if you can help it. It's going to be a lot less messy.
Yeah.
There are tools that will let you do it, but then you're going to start you got to remember to delete the, is this the HEIF or is this the JPEG? Does it have the data in it? I think it's better to just let your JPEGs stay as JPEGs and move forward with the new format.
But you can if you need to. It's a great format, though, for the iPhone because it stores effectively the raw data in addition to the rendered JPEG, in addition to motion data.
Yeah.
It's a really great format.
Because there's actually no such thing as a HEIF file. It's a container. It's an HEIC file. And the great thing about that is it can contain almost anything. So right. It can contain videos, it can contain stills, it can be a stack of it. It's not yet doing like live photos in there, but you can imagine them putting live photo data in there. And what it does do right now is all of the depth data from the depth sensing cameras. Right. That all rides along in the container. So you can take a picture with an iPhone X and then copy it to a Mac running photos in High Sierra and change the depth effect on it.
Does HEIF have to be lossy? I mean, it stores a lossy image, but it's, it could store a loss.
That's the magic, is it's basically H.265 video codec on. So
it is lossy.
It is, you can shoot a raw photo on your iPhone if you want to, and then there's no loss at all. It's all right out of it. But HEIF is meant to be a lossy format. Just a way more efficient one because it's newer.
Right.
And HEVC the same way. Okay. It's way more efficient.
So it isn't really a replacement for camera raw. It is...
It's a replacement for JPEG.
JPEG. Okay.
And the and HEVC is for MP4.
Some additional data like depth information that would normally be lost.
Because they know that now when we take a picture, we're not just taking a still. We're taking all sorts of other sensor data with it.
Right. Question two.
All right, number two. Hello.
Hello.
I'd like to install Windows 10 on my Mac through Boot Camp. I just did this. I know you need the ISO for Windows to install, but I have a slow internet connection. How can I use the DVD or USB drive versions? Signed, Steve. I have an answer for this.
If you have, first of all, where the hell are you going to get a DVD version?
Well, you can go. Well, that's the question, right? Last time I went to the Microsoft store, they sold me a USB version of the installer. But Apple's got a tech note about this. Basically, the answer is you can actually put that DVD in. See, here it is. Apple wants an ISO image file, which, yes, you can download from Microsoft. But if you've got the DVD, you can use Disk Utility, follow the instructions
make
in the Apple Tech
Note.
You make yourself an ISO instead of downloading it, and then put that in the Boot Camp Assistant, and it will use that as the basis. So you need disk space, because you're going to need to save the contents of that DVD into an ISO file on your drive. But then it will proceed as if you had downloaded that ISO from Microsoft.
You should also obviously know that you have to have a licensed copy of Windows if you want to use it for more than 30 days.
Right. You should know that.
You still have to buy a serial number.
But if you've got a slow connection and you can get to a store that's selling it, I am fortunate to live not too far from a Microsoft store, and I found myself needing a new copy of Windows.
So you bought the USB version.
I just drove up and I got a little USB
version.
That's
interesting. I didn't know they did that.
And it's in a little cardboard box, with a nice license card. So.
How interesting.
And in the end, I didn't use the USB because Apple just wanted me to download the ISO. So all I did was open the box, get out the card, type in the serial number.
You needed the number, yeah.
But that was good enough.
I bet you Windows would run nicely on that iMac Pro.
So far, and Apple, I checked with Apple, they are running... The Boot Camp Assistant will download all the drivers. I got it up and running, and
it works
with the screen and Bluetooth and Wi-Fi.
How big a partition did you make for a Windows?
I think it is 64 gigs.
Okay. That's all?
Yeah.
That's enough?
Yeah. It's enough, and I can also do external storage. Sometimes for Steam games, I'll plug in an external USB and put the
games on
there.
Have a Windows drive.
But it's way bigger than my old one. Now that I got the terabyte drive, I think my old one was like a 20-gig partition, and Windows 10 did not like that. Turns out Windows... wants more space than 20 gigs.
Shocking.
Yeah. What did
I
know?
Thank you for the great questions. We appreciate it. You can email us anytime. It's newscreensavers@twit.tv. We always want more questions. We'll either put you on the air or you can get it answered
in the box.
Mailbag. Be in the box if you want. It's a great experience living in that box
for
a whole week.
Playing cards.
Yep.
You can play cards.
newscreensavers@twit.tv is the email address. We also have a newsletter. If you want to subscribe, get your advance warning about things that are coming up on the network so you can avoid them or watch them as your choice might be. twit.tv/newsletter.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Inside news, announcements, so forth. Subscribe to our show or just watch it. Now, here's the deal. Like with any of the shows, we do them live on the air, so you can watch live if you want at twit.tv/live. This particular show, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time on Saturdays. That's 2300 UTC. So you can tune in, you'll watch maybe a little of rehearsal or whatever, and some extra stuff, all the good stuff that we take out. Mm-hmm. All of that will be available. And if you do that, please do me a favor. Join us in the chat room. We love having friends in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. You can go there anytime with a browser, or if you have an IRC client, instructions on the website, irc.twit.tv. If you want to be in studio, we do ask that you email us ahead of time. We don't like surprises. Tickets, and we have an armed guard. So just I'm just saying. Does he have a taser, too? So you might get tased instead of shot? Sure. Okay. So email, in other words.
Let us know which one you prefer.
Which would you like? You get your choice. No, we not. So far, we haven't had to tase anybody or shoot anybody. Email tickets at twit.tv. Don't be the first. I'm just saying.
he's very nice.
Mo's great.
Armed.
And a former Marine. Armed.
Yes.
And he served in Fallujah, I think. So he knows everything there is to know about this. Tickets at twit.tv.
So pick the taser.
We tease Mo. He's great. Tickets at twit.tv. You can also get on-demand versions of all of our shows. If you can't be in studio, you can't watch the stream, just go to twit.tv, in this case, twit.tv/NSS, and download. Better, you know, why do the downloading manually when you can have something do it for you? Your favorite podcast app will do it. In fact, while you're in your podcast app, subscribe to all of our shows, and then subscribe to The Incomparable. Jason.
Yeah, do that.
It's a wonderful show. And the next issue of The Incomparable.
It's The Incomparable Radio Theater. You can go to theincomparable.com/radio.
So excited.
And one of the actors in the next episode is Leo Laporte.
I did this how long ago?
2 years ago. It takes a long time to make radio theater, okay? But the
He's
point
been
is.
He's editing for 2 years.
It's really well edited, let me tell you. To a T. But I'll tease it by saying Leo plays either a monster, someone killed horribly by a monster, or both. Mm. And you did a great job.
It was a lot of fun. Please ask me back. You never ask me back.
Well, now that we're finally making them again, I will ask you back.
I thought I didn't pass the audition.
We had to get this one out first, and now you can come back.
Is it
it's a lot of fun.
Tip of Kindness issue?
No, it's the next one. It'll be 2.4. It'll be out in a couple of days.
Incomparable Radio Theater. Is there other great podcasts too at theincomparable.com?
Thank you, yeah.
And of course, his bread and butter is sixcolors.com. How's that doing? It's doing well, I feel like.
It's doing good.
You left IDG. You were executive editor there, editor of Macworld Magazine. And you went out on your own, and I'm so proud of you for doing that. And it has been a good thing.
Yeah, it's been very good. The writing has been good, and the podcast stuff has been great, too. Good. So a little bit, I'm sort of a hybrid writer-podcaster.
I rely on you, I'm telling you. And frankly, it was your T2 article that said, maybe I got to get this iMac Pro. This thing looks good. Find out more at sixcolors.com. See all of Jason's work there. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next week with Father Robert back from CES. Boy, will his feet be tired.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see that have holes in his shoes. It's big. We'll see you then. Thanks for joining us. See you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye, everybody. Oh, yeah, we got to do that. Yeah!